Welcome to Class Matters, an educational program examining the role played by social classes and the class divide in the U.S. and around the world. I'm Rich Whitney.
I'm Paula.
We discuss matters of class because class matters. And today on Class Matters, we're going to return to the subject of regulatory capture. That is how the very agencies that the federal, well, and sometimes state governments have set up to regulate big corporations and prevent corporate malfeasance and injuring or killing people in the name of profiteering. Those agencies that are supposed to protect us have themselves been captured by the big corporations that they are supposed to be regulating and protecting us from. And this is a huge problem, and we've seen it especially in the medical pharmaceutical complex. Not only that, of course, there's other examples that could be given, but this is a big one, especially since it goes so centrally to the core issue of public health. Before we get into that, though, just wanted to briefly mention that President Biden's State of the Union address was last week. And, you know, there was so much gushing of praise because whatever drugs he was taking, he seemed more alert and more with it and more in command and more
vigorous.
Exactly.
Vigorous. I don't think he talked about the state of the actual union at all, though, did he?
Well, I suppose he touched on it. But regardless of that, yeah, it was largely a political speech. I just wanted to mention, though, that Matt Taibbi, one of the real journalists who we often feature in this program, had a great article at his website, Racket News. I think it's at taibbi.substack.com, but if you look up Racket News, you should be able to find it. And it was just about that, just about how the mainstream media are so, so clearly partisan because the deep state apparently wants to reelect Joe Biden. Well, the corporate media follows suit and they do the promotion. And that's why it's either pro-Biden or anti-Trump all the time.
It's like Emperor's New Clothes to the max.
Yeah.
Oh, he had the most beautiful rainbow cloak and he wore it so vigorously.
Yeah.
Why, the man, he doesn't look a day over 40. Because they've turned the whole senility issue, the whole dementia issue, into an age issue.
Right.
So they can call people ageist. It isn't about age at all, of course. It's about mental acuity.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Whatever drugs they had him on, they worked, I guess. Of course, it made him angry, Biden. You know,
right,
he screamed
right
through the whole thing. But everybody, you know, all the Democrats jumped up like every couple of sentences, sometimes just one sentence, and they applaud. They're trying to run out the time so that he didn't go off script like he did a couple years ago when he was talking about the president of China.
Oh.
Xi, who wants to be President Xi? Nobody wants to be President Xi. Nobody. How does that even go in a State of the Union address, number one? It's so far beyond the bounds of diplomacy, number two.
Yeah.
It's so undignified for a president to be screaming about another president that nobody wants to be that president. I bet they'd rather be him than you, Mr. Demented One. I mean, it was absolutely bizarre, but this is not commented on. This is never mentioned that this is not diplomatic. This is not what you want in your chief executive.
Yeah.
But anyhow, this time he didn't do it because they applauded so much. The time ran out before his speech ran out. So, yay. I guess we should all be really proud that we finally have a president we can be proud of.
Right. Yeah. So there have been other great commentaries, of course, but just wanted to mention Taibbi's at Racket News. Also in kind of the same category of stories we don't have time to cover, but you might want to check out at Consortium News, another great source that we often go to. Patrick Lawrence has a really good article on the hearings investigating Biden for possible impeachment. And that, of course, has to do with Hunter Biden and
what
appears to be strong evidence of corruption regarding deal-making with China and so on and so forth. And you can read about that at Consortium News. But to get now to the main topic, this will probably be the first of a two-parter. And previously, we had gone to this website before. This is from the website MidwesternDoctor.com. It is written by a Midwestern doctor who has chosen to remain anonymous to protect probably his career.
No
because
doubt.
You don't advance in that career by criticizing big pharma, typically.
It'd be cool if he lived around here, right? It'd be cool to have a doctor this smart.
Yeah, yeah,
and
that's
right.
And
as interested in the subject of medicine as he is.
Yeah, and he's written a whole series of articles in this, and we wanted to cover another one. This is actually from back in October, but you can still find it at that website, and it's entitled How Big Pharma Bought the Federal Government. He begins, "For a society to function, it requires a collective trust in the society's institutions. One of the most challenging things for many to come to terms with throughout COVID-19 has been how each institution we trusted to protect us instead pushed a variety of unjustifiable policies and then refused to stop pushing them even as public protests broke out against the harm those policies were creating. I would argue that what we saw throughout the pandemic was ultimately a consequence of two things. One, medicine is one of the United States' most lucrative industries. The amount we spend on it has steadily increased year to year. And then two, the practice of medicine is controlled by regulatory bodies who grant monopolies to any party who can complete the arduous task needed to earn their seal of approval. Because of this, an immense incentive exists to buy out the regulators. So unscrupulously spending large amounts of money to earn a coveted spot in the medical marketplace has become a routine business practice for the pharmaceutical industry. In turn, as time has moved forward and the medical industry has continued to grow, for example, in 2021, $4.3 trillion went to healthcare, amounting to 18.3% of all spending in the U.S.
Well, that's weird because there was a lockdown around there, right? So it wasn't people going to the doctor.
Oh, right.
It was the drugs.
Yeah, yeah.
Remdesivir don't come cheap, dude. And those vaccines, geez, they spent billions on those.
Right, and the hospitalizations and the ventilators and all
that stuff. Oh, $35,000 bonus to a hospital for everyone they put on a ventilator.
Yeah, yeah.
That starts to add up.
Yep, yep. In any event, as this industry has continued to grow, our Midwestern doctor writes, the corruption that sustains it has proliferated throughout our institutions. Because of the wanton disregard for the science we saw throughout COVID-19, much of the public now believes our institutions are thoroughly corrupt. However, what is much less understood is the anatomy of that corruption and how deeply it has entwined itself within the federal government. A common practice I repeatedly witness is a new institution being created by strongly investing in creating the idealized version of it. Then once that ideal version has earned the public's trust and everyone becomes invested in its new way of doing things, to the point they can't return to how things were before, the screws are gradually tightened on the institution. Once this happens, those who work within the institution often become willing to compromise on their values and ethics. For example, a college education was originally considered a specialized path for those genuinely interested in scholarly pursuits.
Or rich people.
Yeah, that too. However, after it became a way of individuals to dodge being drafted into the Vietnam War, many more began pursuing it, which made the federal government's willingness to provide unconditional loans to anyone wishing to pursue a college education give birth to an enormous industry which rapidly inflated the costs of a college tuition.
Didn't that happen more in the 90s than the 70s? I don't remember that happening in the 70s.
Well, I think he said over time this happened. I agreed. College education was still pretty affordable in the 1970s for the most part in most places. In any event, this in turn increasingly incentivized colleges to prioritize growth and to retain their failing students so those students would continue paying tuition. In parallel to this, the job of a college professor radically changed. Previously, they were in short supply. Now a glut of them exists in the marketplace, especially since the growth-focused mentality of higher education has eliminated the previous stipulation that professors needed to be selected on the basis of their academic merit. Because of this, there are many professors, often with PhDs, who have a low enough salary they need food stamps to make their ends meet, and he's got a link to that, and hence cannot do anything which challenges their employers. For example, I've talked to numerous professors who have stated that they have been forced by their administration to disregard cheating from their students so they would continue to pay tuition. And a cottage industry now exists for professors to make money on the side by writing papers, such as a thesis, for students seeking a degree. Then he adds a note here.
Oh, AI is going to get rid of that.
That's right. Yeah, really. Now that's being automated away.
Yeah.
One of the best compilations I saw of the increasing corruption within the educational sector came from a blog by an anonymous college professor. Again, a link. As you might imagine, this issue has also seeped into the medical field, as medical schools make a lot of money. In turn, as the years have gone by, colleagues have shared increasingly concerning instances of cheating being swept under the rug, or them being pressured by the administration to find ways to pass students who should have otherwise failed. Likewise, since the position of a professor, and often a graduate student, is so dependent on the papers they publish, they are incentivized to fabricate data so their paper can be published. And many studies have shown this fraud has become a widespread issue within the scientific literature. Or I guess we could add academic literature in light of what recently happened to Claudine Gay over at Harvard, right?
Yeah. There is a quote that a lot of people quote. It was from the former editor of the American Journal of Medicine, one of the most prestigious medical journals considered in the country. And she said, you know, over the last 20 years, I have got to say, I'm sorry to say it, but you can't trust these studies anymore. There's fraud and there's lying and there's, fudge the results. They start with the end and then they jiggle. Well, it's kind of like 9/11. They started with what they wanted in Building 7, right? Professor David Ray Griffin, an actual intelligent tenured professor from way back when, pointed out that what they did was they couldn't figure out how to say that the building fell without explosives.
Right.
So instead, they put it into a computer. It still didn't work. So then they just fiddled with the numbers until they got a result they wanted.
Yeah.
And that's kind of indicative of how these things work now. But when you're talking about your life and they just make up studies because they have the result they want and then they just jiggle the statistics to make it fit.
Right, yeah.
You could be killed because of that.
Yeah, yeah. One of the most overt examples we saw of this came from the recent discovery that immediately after the leak occurred at the Wuhan lab, which Fauci had funded, he panicked and then contacted a group of respected virologists to request they produce a paper to prove COVID-19 could not have come from a lab. The virologists in turn did just that, and Fauci repeatedly used their paper to debunk the lab leak hypothesis.
And even worse, two of those virologists, once the emails came out, two of them had said almost immediately, you know what, I've looked at the genome of this virus, and it can't possibly be something from nature.
Yeah.
Then they each got $1 million grant, and then each of them then participated in this fraud, which Fauci used to push his particular agenda.
Yeah, except you understated one fact, because the Midwestern doctor goes on to say, shortly after, the lead author had a $9.8 million research grant.
Oh, it wasn't a million, it was 9.8.
Research grant from the NIH approved, which Fauci held the final say on, which that author lied to Congress about. And later leaked chat messages emerged showing the paper's authors also lied to the world, as they themselves believed the virus had come from a lab.
Oh, so, yeah. That's what I was talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, just the number was almost 10 times greater.
I'm always afraid people accuse me of exaggerating, so I tend to lowball stuff, you know?
Right,
saying.
There you go. Then he adds another note. This paper also formed the basis for big tech aggressively censoring anyone who suggested a lab leak had occurred. Had the lab leak hypothesis have been allowed to enter the public discourse, Fauci likely would not have been allowed to direct the response to the pandemic he himself was responsible for creating, especially given that in response to public outcry over previous leaks of dangerous pathogens, Obama had effectively banned Fauci's research. Well, I guess we quibble with effectively.
It wasn't effective at all. He put a moratorium on gain-of-function research, just gain-of-function part.
Right.
Because he was petitioned by eminent scientists who actually had ethics, unlike Fauci. And they said, this is dangerous. We can't be doing this.
Yeah.
So Obama put the moratorium in, and then Fauci just moved it over to Wuhan.
Yeah.
And then right before Obama left, they changed it.
Yeah.
They took off the moratorium.
Yeah. More recently, it was revealed Fauci also covertly met with the CIA when they were deliberating if SARS-CoV-2 came from a lab. The CIA, in turn, publicly announced the lab leak could not be proven.
Because the chief suspect told us it wasn't true.
Yeah, and this, among other things, required bribing the team responsible for the CIA's assessment. And again, he's got links throughout the, I'm not going to keep saying he's got links. He has links through just about every single sentence in this article. This is a very well-documented article. Another noteworthy example occurred after the vaccines had hit the market and many recipients began developing complex neurological illnesses from them. Some of those individuals, e.g. the clinical trial participants, contacted the NIH for help and were enrolled in a study to evaluate and treat their concerning disorders. According to one participant, Brianne Dressen, the NIH was initially very interested in helping them and learned from the FDA that it was aware of other clinical trial participants who had been injured, but once it became clear neurological injuries were a frequent complication of the vaccine, the NIH appears to have decided its best move was to try and bury everything and hence ghost the people it was evaluating for the neurological illnesses.
I say there was a bribe involved there also.
Yeah.
There had to be. Why would they do that? That's not their job. So if for people to not do their job, there has to be a financial reason
right.
They didn't do their job.
Yeah, right. Follow the money, as always. Incidentally, there's another very good article that Pierre Corey came out with on his website talking about the latest evidence showing that the so-called long COVID, some of it is long COVID, but a great deal of it may be long vaccine injury, not long COVID. And some interesting research being done there.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because the thing about COVID is, for almost everybody, especially people under 85, it was mostly in their lungs, like
right.
any respiratory disease. Sometimes it would get out and it would go to other organs, and that's when it caused the big damage. That's what killed people. It wasn't actually pneumonia that killed them. It was usually some other, the spike proteins getting out
yeah.
of the lungs and moving on. But what they did with the vaccine was they injected a substance to make your cells produce spike proteins, which then got into the bloodstream, and they went everywhere all over your body.
Yeah.
It didn't come through the respiratory tract, which has all kinds of protections, obviously, because humans are very susceptible to respiratory viruses and bacteria.
Sure.
So we have all kinds of defenses. There's a whole different immune system or complementary immune system that's just in your respiratory tract.
You're right, right.
And that was totally bypassed when they started injecting people with the spike protein that caused all the problems from the virus itself.
Right. Yeah.
And they're like, we picked the spike protein because it's just so easy for your body to recognize. Yeah, that's nice. And it also destroys any organs or endothelial cells it comes in contact with.
Yeah. And speaking of spikes and spike proteins, we've talked before about how there was a spike in the death rate, that the overall global death rate that coincided with the introduction of the vaccines, more pronounced than any death rate associated with COVID itself.
Right.
And on top of that, as Dr. Corey writes in his recent column, there has been a comparable surge in disabilities of people of working age, ages 16 to 64, huge increase in claims for disability coinciding with the period in which the vaccine was introduced.
Yeah, well, when you're paralyzed, or I remember that pilot who didn't want it, but they said, we'll fire you unless you take it. So he took it, then he had a heart attack, then he was on all kinds of drugs and stuff, and he became totally disabled. So he lost his job anyhow.
Yeah.
But instead of losing his job and being healthy, he lost his job because he was severely disabled.
Yeah.
And that's, just multiply that all over the place.
Yeah. Anyway, resuming the article, the NIH publicly denied there was any evidence neurological vaccine injuries were occurring and repeatedly pushed back the date they'd promised Dressen and others to publish the study evaluating them. Had that study been published on time, it would have greatly helped many of the patients suffering neurological injuries that supposedly couldn't exist, because there was no peer-reviewed literature substantiating those injuries, or more importantly, guidelines on how to treat them. In short, I'd argue that the debasement of our educational system has rippled out into the entire society, as we depend on its graduates to turn the gears of everything, that is, by appropriately conducting scientific research, And if we have incompetent or dishonest personnel occupy those positions, the institutions they staff decay as well. He also notes that this issue was significantly worsened by Obama's decision to prioritize academic qualifications rather than real-world experience in the federal hiring process. Similarly, most of his senior officials had a degree from an Ivy League college. One of the primary ways the thumbscrews have been tightened throughout the society has been by gradually impoverishing everyone except the upper class. Because of this, almost every institution we depend upon is underfunded and thus willing to consider unethical sources of funding. And boy, we've seen that in academia, haven't we? For instance, industry often donates, in quotes, large amounts of money to schools in return for favorable research being pursued there, and then may threaten to withhold those donations unless an unrelated professor within the college stops performing research that is critical of the industry. Within the federal government, this impoverishment comes through budgets being slashed and agencies inevitably looking to the private sector for funding. Yeah, don't we love those public-private partnerships, right?
Some people do.
Yeah, that's right. This is something similar to what was observed in the educational sector, although the scale of it is often far worse. For example, in 1983, Congress authorized the CDC to accept gifts made unconditionally for the benefit of the public health service or for the carrying out of any of its functions.
Jeez, that is just an open invitation to corruption.
Yeah, it is. It literally is. Then in 1992, Congress established the National Foundation for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention so that CDC could obtain additional funding for its work, or put differently, created a third party for passing tainted money to the CDC. The CDC Foundation has been accused of egregious conduct since its inception and has received nearly $1 billion from corporate donors, in quotes.
That's egregious right there.
Yeah. The potential for the foundation enabling corruption, in turn, has been criticized by many, including by a scathing editorial in one of the world's top medical journals. Many examples of its corruption are documented within this 2019 letter to the CDC. They include being paid by a pesticide industry firm to conduct a study to prove the safety of two pesticides.
You can trust that study.
Another example, during the years 2010 to 2015, Coca-Cola contributed more than $1 million to the CDC Foundation. In return, the CDC offered numerous services, including collaborative meetings and advice from a top CDC staffer on how to lobby the World Health Organization to curtail the WHO's initiative to reduce global consumption of added sugars, which is really something given that the CDC has been tasked with fighting obesity.
Oh, they get paid for fighting obesity and they get paid by Coca-Cola to push sugar.
Yeah,
I mean, that payment will never end, either one of them.
That's right. One hand washes the other. That's right. Another example, taking money from Roche, that's the drug firm Roche, to push Tamiflu, which the CDC continues to do to this day, an ineffective and harmful flu treatment which was approved of off data that was kept secret from the public. He adds a note, as of 2019, the CDC also owned 57 vaccine patents and recently spent 4.9 of its $12 billion annual budget buying and distributing vaccines. This may help to explain why the CDC always recommends every vaccine, regardless of the evidence arguing against doing so or how much opposition they receive from the public and sometimes even their own advisors. Members of Congress have even formally complained about the payments to the CDC Foundation, as have anonymous whistleblowers within the CDC.
I bet not members of Congress who get reelected. Well, I'm quite certain that our congressman has never complained about anything that involves big money.
Yeah, you got Senator Ron Johnson and maybe a handful of others,
but it's a
pretty small list.
Rand Paul, Dennis Kucinich probably did.
Yeah.
You know.
In short, the conflicts of interest with the CDC Foundation are immense and help to explain why the CDC always pushes corrupt and harmful policies. For example, many of the profiteers who benefited immensely from the COVID-19 vaccination campaign had previously given the CDC millions.
Best investment they can make.
Yeah.
You know, buying politicians, I think Ralph Nader pointed that out a long time ago. The money back beats any other investment.
Sure.
I mean, you invest in a new factory, you're not going to get the kind of profits as opposed to investing in a politician and having them hand you the public money.
Right, right.
Or public land, public water, allowing you to pollute, any kind of things that's very, very profitable for them. That's a way better investment to make, buying off the politicians and the regulatory agencies.
Yeah, yeah, because typical corporate donations are tens of thousands of dollars maybe, but for those tens of thousands of dollars, they make millions or billions.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So
the return is amazing.
It is. Continuing with the Midwestern Doctor, he adds that many other agencies within the federal government, including the CIA and the NIH, have their own foundations that were also created by Congress to allow them to access corporate bribes, donations that are not subject to legal oversight, such as Freedom of Information Act requests. Not surprisingly, many of the directors of these foundations, like their peers in government, often follow the revolving door and end up in high-paying executive roles at major pharmaceutical companies after leaving the foundations.
I would just like to point out that Freedom of Information Act is another one of those 70s reforms that was passed in response to the increasing secrecy of the government and lawlessness of the government throughout the 60s and 70s. You know, because before that, remember I.F. Stone, who put out a paper called I.F. Stone Weekly. He said all he did was go to the agencies and look at their papers, because before then, they had to publish this stuff.
Sure, right.
You know, the same as I saw a presidential researcher who said before 1980, you could go to the presidential library and you could research anything the presidents did.
Right.
But after that, they started hiding it. They started hiding stuff. So you no longer could just go to where you should be able to go. You should be able to go to agencies and see exactly what's your budget, what are you doing. That should all be there.
Yeah.
You know, you shouldn't have to have a Freedom of Information Act request.
That's
and again,
true.
That they can turn down or whatever.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like the War Powers Act. The presidents after World War II didn't bother asking the Congress to declare war. So the Congress did this reform. Where, well, you can go ahead and start a war, but you have to come and ask us if it's okay after 60 days.
You're right, yeah.
You know, well, what kind of a reform is that?
Yeah, 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 it's nonsense. The Midwestern Doctor continues, the pernicious influence of industry cash can also be seen at the FDA. On October 29th, 1992, in response to public concerns that no AIDS treatments were getting to market, which was a result of Fauci deliberately blocking all of them to clear the way for the deadly and ineffective AZT.
Yeah, he did that before.
Yeah, that's right.
He did the whole remdesivir thing before with the AZT.
Yep, yep.
There's a movie actually made about it. It's called The Dallas Buyers Club. And that's about people with AIDS trying to go to Mexico to try and get drugs that would work.
Right.
And the bad guy in that movie is Anthony Fauci.
Yeah.
And I don't know why people can watch that movie and go, oh, well, he was a bad guy back then, but he's sure a good guy now.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah.
He hasn't changed.
Don't think so. Anyway, in response to those concerns about those lack of AIDS treatments, Congress and then George Bush Sr. signed into law the Prescription Drug User Fee Act, which authorized the FDA to take money from the drug makers it approved drugs for. As a result of this act, drug approval times were shortened, going from 29 months in 1987 to 10 months in 2018, and the percentage of drugs that were approved the first time an approval was requested dramatically increased. Conversely, prior to the act, 21% of medications were removed from the market or had new black box warnings added to them. After the act, this figure increased to 27% as a result of factors such as senior FDA officials overturning its scientists' recommendations and the evidence required for a medication approval being lowered. As a result of these changes, user fees now comprise a significant portion of the FDA's budget, 46% in 2022, for example, and approximately of the 65% of that allotted for regulating drugs used in humans, which not surprisingly has had an increasingly corrupting influence on the FDA's drug approval process. One of the best illustrations of this can be seen within the current FDA Commissioner Robert Califf, who in 2009 was considered to be too close to the industry to nominate to the position, yet in 2021 was appointed to it, and ever since gaining control of the FDA, has advanced the interests of his industry. Well, there's more to this article, but we're going to have to cut it here, I think, because we are about out of time. But we're going to come back to this next week on Class Matters. For now, though, thanks for listening to Class Matters, and we'll be with you again next Monday.